talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I amuse you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Good morning and welcome to the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And today is October 5th. Monday, October 5th. Let's start out with the box office like we usually do every week. Michelle, how did The Martian do?
Oh my gosh, it did fabulous. Ridley Scott's The Martian was number one with an estimated $55 million, combined with international markets of $45.2
million.
That's
pretty
good. The Martian has a worldwide total of $100 million.
Now, weren't they just predicting about 45 for the U.S.?
That 20th Century Fox had estimates very low, but everybody was thinking, because of the stellar reviews, great word of mouth, and critical raves. Plus, it opened in 3,800 theaters.
Yeah, but it's 2.5 hours, so $55 million is pretty good.
Yeah. That goes pretty fast. Realty also announced that 20th Century Fox's epic space adventure generated 46% of the estimated $55 million in the 3D format. So 3D format, you know, is really, it's a lot of the gross for these opening weekend films. In Variety's box office story about it, analysts said the numbers fall just short of Gravity's $55.8 million debut. But there were also a number of factors that prevented The Martian from topping that picture in the record books. Gravity had the benefit of several IMAX locations, which were being held exclusively this time around for Sony's The Walk, depriving The Martian of some healthy surcharges.
Gravity was it was like
same weekend.
Like an hour and a half long, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about an hour shorter, yeah.
Yeah, so that probably helped Gravity, too.
I didn't see The Martian in 3D. I saw it over the High Point. Is the 3D, was it worth the upcharge?
I think so, but
I don't know. You know, definitely with The Walk, it's worth it. But Martian, it's, you know, either way, I think it's pretty great.
All right. Well, let's continue with the top 10 list. Number two.
Coming in at number two is Hotel Transylvania 2 with $33 million, dropping only 31% over the weekend. Followed by Sicario at number three with $12.1 million. It added an additional 2,500 theaters this weekend, and it's got an A-minus cinema score. Also performing well in its second weekend is The Intern at number four with $11.6 million. And The Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials, is number five with $7.7 million. Black Mass came in at number six with $5.9 million. Everest is number seven with $5.5 million. And M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit is number eight with $3.9 million. At number nine is War Room from Sony Pictures. That's number nine with $2.8 million. And rounding out the top ten was The Perfect Guy at $2.4 million. However, over the weekend, The Walk brought in only $1.5 million. This was only showing at 448 cinemas, bringing its total to a disappointing $1.972 million.
So that's considered bad, opening at that few theaters?
At 448, you know, and should've it was IMAX 3D. However, The Walk expands to 2,500-plus theaters next weekend. So we'll see how it does with the larger audience when they have access
it's
to it.
It's kind of a tough sell.
Yeah, my mother doesn't want to see it. I talked to her over the weekend.
I don't want to see it in 3D. I keep hearing how queasy it makes people.
We were fine.
I
have a sensitive stomach.
I get
queasy at some of those found footage movies. I do. All right, and wait, you didn't mention. Did you mention number 12, The Green Inferno?
Green Inferno dropped. Wait, you know, it dropped off the 12.
No, it was number 12. Green Inferno. Go see Green Inferno.
So it's still at some screens here in town, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of an unpleasant time at the movies. Well, so is Sicario. Let's talk about Sicario now.
Every day across that border, people are killed with his blessing. To find him would be like discovering a vaccine.
Nothing will make sense to your American ears.
But in the end, you will understand.
Okay. Jim and I saw Sicario
last
week. Kate Marquis reviewed it for We Are Movie Geeks and gave it, what did she give it, 4 stars?
I think so.
Something like that. Yeah, she liked it quite a bit. I liked it quite a bit, too. What did you think of Sicario, Jim?
I like most of it there. It's kind of a, you know, talking about Green Inferno being the feel-bad film of the fall. This is kind of a downer, too. It's similar to this director's other films. You know, certainly, you know, Prisoners and things like that. So it's pretty good. They're kind of selling it in an odd way. They're selling it as an Emily Blunt action hero. And by about the midpoint, or at least by the last act, it's pretty much Benicio del Toro's story.
It's a strange structure, isn't it? For the first 90 minutes, it's her story. She's in every scene. It's told from her point of view. And then it veers off. It becomes Benicio del Toro's story and kind of a more conventional revenge thriller when it does that. But you're right. I think that director has done that with Prisoners. I think it became a kidnap drama, and then it sort of turned into a serial killer drama in the last half hour. I think he did that on purpose. But you're right, though. It's very grim, unpleasant. Oh, yes. Children are murdered in the movie. It's not a fun night at the movies.
No. There's a wonderful scene. I don't know about you, Tom. I think that my favorite sequence might have been the scene at the border, which they show a little bit in the trailers. Mm-hmm. That's very intense. Yeah. That's pretty well edited and just a real make your knuckles go white thinking about it. Yeah. That's for sure.
No, that's a great scene. There's a lot of great scenes. It's a very, very good movie.
Yeah, as we say, Blunt is terrific in it. She was terrific in the Tom Cruise Edge of Tomorrow last year also. Yep. And she's, whether it's comedy or historical dramas, she's really presenting herself as a very versatile actress. It'd be interesting to see what her next choices will be. They're talking her up as perhaps Captain Marvel for Marvel Comics.
I've heard Mary Poppins, too.
That's right. I think the rumor is going on about that, too, and I think she could do just about anything. I think she's a terrific actress. You know who's terrific in this also is Josh Brolin. He's becoming sort of the go-to character guy for a lot of films. I know he was terrific in Everest,
sure.
And he's great in this too.
He was Oscar nominated for Milk.
Oh, yes, playing Dan White.
The kind of odd.
And he's going to be Thanos in the Avengers films also. So, but he'll be almost unrecognizable under that purple. But here he's got a sense of menace to him, but he's kind of disguising it with this sort of laid back California guy. And when you first see him in the FBI meeting room, he's wearing sandals,
Birkenstocks,
and you're thinking, well, he's kind of a mellow guy. He's not.
No.
that's to fool you. We were talking about Benicio. He's terrific.
He
also
is. He's
this.
Really good. And it's interesting because he sort of plays he's very mysterious. You don't really know where his allies lie. You don't know what his motivation is until the sort of near the end. He's got his own vendetta going on against a Colombian drug lord.
Yeah, there's a haunted quality to him for that first hour, so you know that something just really horrible happened to this guy. And he's very, very dark in it.
Well, the cinematography is from Roger Deakins. The music, once again, he paired up with Johan Johansson, who he did Prisoners with previously. So, I mean, it's got a lot of top-notch, below-the-line crew.
Well, there was quite a bit made in some of the behind-the-scenes articles about this big tunnel sequence and how intense it is. And it only lasts about 4 or 5 minutes, it seems like. But I much preferred some of the other action sequences.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it was also shot in that night vision photography where everything's sort of like green, and which made it effective because you didn't know what the heck was going on half the time.
Yeah, kind of reminiscent of Zero Dark Thirty that sequence.
The whole
there.
Film is sort of reminiscent of Zero Dark Thirty. It was all about about procedure.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of traffic in there also.
Yeah. But so Jim and I recommend, and Kate also, we all recommend Sicario. Very good film. And like I just said, I think Benicio del Toro is fantastic in the film, which is interesting. The night before I saw Sicario, I watched on Blu-ray a movie called Escobar Paradise Lost.
If you see anything strange around here, you come and tell me. Not a word to anyone. I have to trust everyone near me. Understand?
We usually don't review Blu-ray releases here at We Are Movie Geeks because I just think there's plenty of new movies to review, but I wanted to make an exception with this because it's so interesting to see Benicio del Toro in Sicario, where he plays someone with a vendetta against a Mexican drug lord, but in Escobar Paradise Lost, he plays a very famous Colombian drug lord, Pablo Escobar, who controlled most of the cocaine industry in the 70s and 80s out of Colombia. And this movie, Escobar Paradise Lost, is supposed to be his story, but guess what? It doesn't star Benicio del Toro. It stars Josh Hutcherson.
Yeah. He's dreamy.
Oh, my gosh.
That was supposed to be one of his star-making vehicles, and it was supposed to receive all this Oscar acclaim.
Yeah.
And
oh, boy.
It never played here in the city. It opened over across the river.
Yeah, over at a theater in Collinsville. And if I'd have known, I didn't know about that until after it was too late. I may have gone over there and seen it because that's the kind of movie I like. True crime stories about drug dealers is right up my alley. This was a really fatal mistake to have Josh Hutcherson in this film because Benicio is so good and so compelling and so mesmerizing as Pablo Escobar. But it's not about him. It's the story of this Canadian kid who's doing a sort of Habitat for Humanity type project down in Colombia where he's building these houses. He meets this young Colombian woman, falls in love with her. Well, she happens to be the niece of Pablo Escobar, and Pablo sort of takes him under his wing and starts sending him out on these assignments. And so he sends him out to steal these diamonds from some of his rival drug lords. So Josh Hutcherson becomes the hero, and he's got this gun, and he's battling all these crime guys. And Benicio's back and sitting on the phone for the last half of the movie in a few scenes. They sort of forget about him, which was just a terrible... You know, we talked last week about this. We talked about how some movies will take a character. And a good example, I think, is... The Last King of Scotland, which was about Idi Amin.
I was just going to say this. The setup sounds like that.
It's similar to that. It's but it's told through the eyes of a young white guy. But it worked in The King of Scotland. In Glory, we talked about last week, which was about black soldiers fighting the Civil War. Yet the main character was Matthew Broderick, who was their leader. It worked in that film because those were good films. To make a story about Pablo Escobar, I don't know why they didn't. His story is fascinating, but instead they stuck in this goofy Josh Hutcherson running around with a gun, and it ruined it. It's a lame movie.
Well, it sounds kind of similar also to Stonewall, as they want to get a character pushing the story forward who's more accessible to audiences.
Yeah, it's not like relatable.
And for box office reasons, I guess. I mean, Josh stars in these Hunger Games movies, so I guess they figure maybe teenage girls are going to go see this Escobar movie because they want to see Josh. It failed, obviously. I don't think the movie made any money. It comes out on Blu-ray tomorrow. It's worth seeing just for Del Toro's performance as Escobar, but it's not really about Escobar. It's an unfortunate decision by the producers.
Strange ideas there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So Michelle and Jim saw The Walk.
Welcome to New York. Anything to declare?
I'm going to hang a high wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center and walk on it.
Good luck.
I did not see The Walk. Michelle, what did you think of The Walk?
I thought it was fabulous. Oh, I mean, just the whole... It's definitely a must in 3D IMAX. Robert Zemeckis does a fabulous job with it. It's kind of a... And Jim and I were talking about this afterwards, after the screening. It's definitely a love letter to New York City. It's a great way to see the World Trade Center, in all its glory. So I really enjoyed it. I hope people, when it expands to more theaters next week, people see it. But it's a definite 3D IMAX.
Yeah. I do hope that people won't be put off by fears of vertigo or anything like that with it. It's terrific. I think I might have mentioned after the screening that the way it's set up, also besides being a love letter to New York, it's almost like a fairy tale. Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Philippe Petit is telling you a bedtime story.
Mm-hmm. How is
I
Joseph?
I love that approach.
Yeah.
How is Joseph with his French accent?
I didn't really mind it. I thought he was charming,
And his light blue eyes.
Mm-hmm. he's an interesting character. I've read some reviews of it. I guess the real fellow, some people find a little abrasive, but Gordon, he's a lovely guy. He throws a couple of tantrums in it though. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When these things aren't quite going his way or people aren't cutting it.
Right.
But
the relationship with his mentor played by Ben Kingsley.
Ben Kingsley's very good at it. Very terrific. Mm-hmm. I can see him getting a supporting nomination.
Does it generate suspense with the actual walk? Oh, this guy lives because they made that documentary a few years ago.
Yeah.
It's like Apollo 13. You know what was going to happen, but it's still very intense.
Yeah, this is a film with one of the strongest last acts I've seen in a long time because the last half hour or so is just riveting.
And it's rated PG, and Zemeckis has said he wants people to come with families. But I mean, that last half hour.
Yeah, and he gets the period right with the clothing and everything, the 70s fashions. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't aware that when the when the towers were going up, most New Yorkers weren't very happy about them. They were kind of making fun of them. They said they looked like big metal filing cabinets. This walk kind of endeared the towers to everybody in New York. They mentioned about how actually the people, the management of the towers were kind of happy that even though they had to, of course, throw Philippe into jail and all that, they were kind of happy. This kind of humanized the towers.
I figured the remake of King Kong would have endeared everyone to this.
Well, that came a little later.
World Trade Center.
And I appreciated the powerful score from Alan Silvestri, who has worked with Zemeckis before. The score was really great.
Well, yeah, and it seemed like he was sort of doing a 60s heist film for about the middle section of it, as the guys are sort of getting together and forming a team.
Definitely.
In order to do that and kind of mapping out what they're going to do. And it's like a big diamond heist or something, like an Ocean's 12 or 13 or something.
Yeah, it's really well done.
Good. So, Jim and Michelle, did you review it, Jim?
No, Kate did.
Oh, Kate did. Okay.
Kate did it for the IMAX opening.
Okay. Four and a half.
Four and a half, all right. So, Michelle and Jim liked The Walk. Last week, Jim reviewed at length The Martian.
Now, you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates. And to NASA. And to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise.
Michelle and I had not seen it, but I think we both caught up with it in the past
and
week.
And how?
I saw it Saturday night over at the High Point. I thought
Tell me what an idiot I am for liking it so much. Right?
I thought it was a great movie, but I was a little disappointed. I sat there for 2 hours waiting for the Martian to show up. There were no Martians in this movie. Well, it's the most misleading title since the Never-Ending Story.
Well, in my review, I said there's no BIMs in it, no bug-eyed monsters.
What did you think, Michelle, of The Martian?
Fabulous. I mean, from beginning to end. Like I've said before, huge fan of the book. So I really, really liked it. The pacing was good. The editing was great. Cinematography. Mm-hmm. Matt Damon. I'll be really interested to see what happens come, this upcoming award season.
Yeah, I think he's
supporting
he's a
cast
contender.
Is fabulous,
yeah.
too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was a little concerned. I double checked after we did the podcast to make sure it was PG-13 because I knew that he drops a couple of F-bombs in it.
I noticed that too.
But if you can cover your kids' ears during those moments, because it's a terrific film. Like The Walk for the whole family. Yeah.
Right.
My kids hear worse from me in traffic. Jim and Michelle also saw Bridge of Spies, which is the new film from Steven Spielberg.
Something important has come up.
We've got a Soviet spy.
But there's a wrinkle.
We've got our spy pilot. With a head full of classified information. The Russians want their man back before he cracks. We want you to negotiate the swap.
I'm an insurance lawyer. I'm not sure I want to pick that up.
Jim, what's Bridge of Spies about?
Well, it mostly concerns Gary Francis Powers' U2 spy plane incidents from the early 60s, late 50s. It actually starts in the late 50s. This is the U2 thing is the incident most people know about, but they probably don't know about Tom Hanks' character. I believe his name is Donaldson, I believe. But he was a lawyer in New York, and he is sort of tagged by the government to present a defense for this Russian spy that's caught. Rudolf Bing, I believe, was his name. He deserves a trial and all that, they say, and he's, Tom's not wanting to do it, but he's going to go ahead and do it, and he basically pleads for him not to get the death penalty, like the Rosenbergs, they mentioned them quite a bit in it, that he might be of use later on as for an exchange, and it turns out he does when the U2 spy plane goes down. Hanks' character is tagged again to be the unofficial sort of broker of this deal between the Soviets and the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it's most of it's set in Berlin at the time of the building of the wall. And it's actually around the same period as the Man from U.N.C.L.E. film a few months ago. So there is a little prologue explaining to younger viewers what the Cold War was. Mm. And during the course of the film, they even have a scene with Tom Hanks's children in school watching the duck and cover, the little turtle, ducking and cover for when the atomic blast flashes. And it's just, amazing. And I think a lot of people will think, well, that can't be real, but it was very, very real.
He almost becomes, Tom Hanks, he plays James Donovan. He's this Jonathan insurance lawyer. He almost morphs into like a Jimmy Stewart.
Exactly, exactly.
And yeah. Mark Rylance as the Soviet spy Rudolf Abel is just that's the standout performance.
Yeah, so is the movie again, though. What do you guys think of it?
It is well done.
It opened at the New York Film Festival last night. Had its big premiere. Everybody was there for it, and there were reviews. Reviews were released. The embargo's off last night. So I think it's an interesting look at the time, what was going on. You know, the subject matter has, you know, below the line. Once again, it's Spielberg. It's one of his. It's a really top-notch film. Of note, John Williams does not do the score. It's a Thomas Newman score, which is a first.
What was Spielberg's last film? Was it War Horse or was
Lincoln?
Lincoln.
It's been a couple of years.
So this is closer to the Spielberg from Munich, but I don't think it's as strong as Munich was. Uh-huh. It is a tough film, and there's a little bit of his whimsy in it, dealing with the 1950s and all that. But
is it Alan Alda in it?
Alan Alda's terrific again. Yeah, he's a great getting to be a great character actor these days with this role, and he's similar to the Aviator role he did. It's pretty great. So make you forget he was in a Nicholas Sparks film earlier this year and had to suffer through that. But no, it's really very very well done. I think it could get a little Oscar love with Mark Rylance, maybe a couple of technical ones, but I don't think it's going to be the awards machine this end of the year.
No,
I think there's
some
stronger films coming out or have come out already, but it's pretty good flick.
So Jim gives it thumbs up.
Yeah.
Michelle, you like it?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. That will open on October 16th, so look for a review at wearemoviegeeks.com next week. There's a couple of documentaries that open here in St. Louis this weekend. There's a documentary about National Lampoon. That's a great subject to make a documentary. Oh, what's that called?
That is called Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead.
What a great title. And you've seen it, Jim?
In those days, magazines were a bigger deal.
People defined themselves by the magazines they read.
Breasts. You got the magazine on the off chance that there would be some breasts.
Tell me about National Lampoon. Why do you think it's so popular?
They're designed to flatter a particular audience of fairly well-to-do nobodies.
So there's this wonderful freedom.
If you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog.
We can do anything we want!
I have seen it.
Tell us about it.
That's going to open Friday, I believe, over at the Tivoli. And if you were in high school in the 70s, you knew about the magazine, the National Lampoon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of the movie geeks maybe just know it as the first couple of lines of a movie title. But then it was the magazine. When you kind of outgrew Mad a little bit,
yeah.
You needed something racier.
Much racier
with some nudity. There's some nudity in there. And it was sort of the bridge between Mad and the underground comics that were big back then. But it's a very entertaining doc. It's mostly talking heads. They talk to a lot of the people that were behind the scenes on the magazine back then. Even Matty Simmons, who I didn't realize was still around, who was the publisher. And they do talk to a couple of the people involved in the Lampoon films. They talk with Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo, and Tim Matheson and Kevin Bacon. They have some wonderful footage when Lampoon started to expand from the magazine into different media. They first had a stage show called National Lampoon's Lemmings, and there's some great footage of John Belushi and Chevy Chase on stage for that. They have quite a bit from the National Lampoon Radio Hour, which was a syndicated one-hour radio comedy show that aired in the mid-70s that Belushi became the producer of after Michael O'Donohue. Quite a bit about Mr. Mike in the film there, Michael O'Donohue. And then they talk about the movies, and of course they have to talk about what an enormous hit Animal House was, and of course the stories about how the head of Universal hated it, and it just became this worldwide sensation, and Lampoon became the toast of the town. They do talk about their little fall from grace with the Disco Beaver from Outer Space, the HBO special, and then coming back with Vacation. They talk a little about John Hughes being part of the magazine, and his short story being the inspiration for that. But the main thrust of the film is sort of the tragic story of Doug Kenny, who was one of the founders. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating story.
He was in a National Lampoon's Animal House.
Oh, yeah.
A small
role. What are we supposed to do, you moron?
That was one of my favorite lines when I first saw it.
So yeah, it's they talk with his co-writer Chris Miller. Terrific film. They do a lot of interesting animation with some of the cartoon characters that used to be in the back of the magazine.
And even the posters are very nostalgic. Have you seen the poster? It's a very very National Lampoon.
Oh yeah, of course they have that most famous cover. They said, if you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog. Yeah. That's great. And then they have a whole montage of the poster art, and it's really interesting. They do my only beef with it is they don't talk about the Sunday newspaper parody, but luckily they do go into depth about the National Lampoon High School Yearbook parody, which is one of the funniest.
I've got some of those
most incredibly detailed pieces of humor you've ever seen. Yeah. It's just terrific. Ever get a chance to check that out from the library? Hopefully it's being reprinted by someone. Mm. It's just a classic. But if you grow up with that magazine, then this documentary is a must see. It's
so
very entertaining.
Recommends the National Lampoon Dockery. What's the name of it again?
Drunk, Stone, Brilliant, Dead.
Let's see. Another documentary, actually it opened this past Friday, it's called Finders Keepers.
I'd seen the grill and ended up buying it. And I opened the grill up, and there's a foot, five toes and five toenails. I decided to keep it.
The Smoker Grill is now a tourist attraction.
I can't believe. I mean, who is this guy? That's my leg.
He lost his leg 3 years ago, and that's just one hurdle life has thrown at him.
I've been shot, run over by a state dump truck, electrocuted. I've been through a lot.
And it seems to be doing well. People are talking about this documentary. I did watch it over the weekend. It's from the producers who did King of Kong, which was a documentary a couple years ago about a guy who was the champion of Donkey Kong, and he came up against another guy who claimed he was the champion. It was an interesting documentary. This one is about, a guy who buys things from storage units that have defaulted on their payments. So he finds this sort of barrel-shaped grill known as a smoker, and he takes it home, opens it up, and there's a human leg inside of it. And then we're introduced to the leg's owner, who was this fellow who was in a small plane crash that killed his father and injured him badly enough that he had to have his leg amputated below the knee and put it in this grill for storage, and then it becomes this battle between these two men. The guy who found it in the grill wants to keep it, and he puts the grill out in his driveway, and he charges people money to come and look at this leg, and it becomes this human interest story, and they eventually go on one of these TV judge shows.
Is it Judge Mathis?
Yes, it was Judge Mathis, exactly. Yes. So I don't think it's nearly as interesting as King of Kong, because these two men aren't that interesting. The guys in King of Kong had big, bizarre personalities.
Oh, very entertaining. Yeah. Yes.
And this one, these guys, they're real sort of redneck, a little Duck Dynasty going on with these guys. It sort of runs out of steam. After it introduces its premise and goes on for about a half hour, it becomes sort of redundant, I thought. I'm not sure why it's become such a smash among the documentary scene. But I think it apparently did real well at the Frontenac over the weekend, so they'll probably be keeping it at least one more week.
Yeah, I think the director was over there at the Frontenac this weekend with it. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Friday night, yeah.
But, so you're saying that if you could see King of Kong, that's the better doc.
That's much better. Finders Keepers, I don't know if it's worth going out to the theater, but maybe when it shows up on Netflix or something in a couple of months, I do recommend it there. But a couple of movies that we'll be reviewing for this week. Jim's seeing 99 Homes tomorrow.
My name's Rick Carver. I'm a licensed real estate broker. This home has been foreclosed on.
No, this is not happening.
I need you, your mom, and your son to step off the property.
This is not your home.
Mr. Carver, please don't.
Sir, you have 2 minutes. Pack whatever belongings you need.
Oh, my God.
Does he have to stand there while she packs up? Is that right?
As Andrew Garfield and Michael Shannon.
Oh yeah, looking forward to it for Michael Shannon. He's a terrific actor. Yeah, it's all about the housing bubble that burst down in I think Florida is where it's set a few years ago, and it looks very interesting. I'm looking forward to it. I'm also seeing tonight. He Called Me Malala. That's the
he
named me Malala. Mm-hmm. That was it. Yes, he has the documentary that's getting a lot of praise. I know that it got an A from Entertainment Weekly this weekend.
It's about a young girl who
was was fighting to get girls in school and get education for women, and for her trouble, the Taliban, you know, shot her in the head.
Oh, well.
So, but
she survived.
She survived, mm-hmm. won the Nobel Prize, and it's about her life living with her family and her brothers and all that. And it's supposed to be very very good. So
sounds like
looking
sounds very well intentioned, if nothing else.
Uplifting story, yes, right. Definitely.
So we'll have we'll review those next week. Kate saw Pan.
Are you brave, Peter?
I tried to be.
The name's James Hook.
I'm trying to save your life, kid.
Why?
Let me handle this.
Good fair lady, we come in peace.
He'll be reviewing that. That has Hugh Jackman. And
yeah.
Who else is in it?
Rooney Mara, I believe, is in it. And I believe, Garrett Dilliard, is his name? The young man that's playing Hook in it. But he's been in a couple of things. So,
okay.
That was a movie that was moved from the summer by Warner Brothers, giving various vague excuses or reasons why it was moving out of the big summer. And they they were releasing trailers, new posters, everything.
Yeah.
Days before they said, whoa, wait a minute, and set out and said, Joe Wright's not quite finished with the movie yet.
Oh, that's right. It's Joe Wright, the fellow that did Atonement.
Yeah.
Garrett Hedlund.
I came pretty close there. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, he was in that Country Strong a couple of years. And Tron Legacy, I remember. Yeah.
So what's the buzz? Is this?
They haven't. There hasn't been any reviews on it yet, so we'll see.
Yeah.
I got a bad feeling about this one, but you never know.
Yeah, I don't know if there's too much more you can get out of the Peter Pan story. I mean, we've had several versions of the original story. We've had Hook on Broadway. We've had Peter and the Starcatcher, which is kind of a prequel, which is what this is, I guess, right?
And it's a family movie, so I mean, by the time everyone's seen Hotel Transylvania 2, if you know, once or twice, as the box office is showing, you know, maybe this will be a good weekend. Next weekend will be a good weekend if you want to take the kids and family to go see.
But it's not a musical, though, as I understand. It's a straight on adventure fantasy.
But right. Hugh Jackman's been promoting it.
Oh yes,
right. Yeah. Well, so look for Kate Marquis' review of Pan later this week at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. It is Vincent Price week in St. Louis.
Yay!
Now, we had Vincent Price month in St. Louis back in May of 2011 when we celebrated the 100th birthday of the late actor who was born and raised here in St. Louis. We're doing three events this weekend because Vincent Price's daughter, Victoria Price, is in town. Victoria was here for Vincentennial in 2011, as was Roger Corman, who directed all those wonderful Edgar Allan Poe adaptions in the 60s, but Victoria wrote a book about her father entitled Vincent Price, A Daughter's Biography. She wrote the book in 1999 when she was here for Vincentennial. That book was out of print. It's back in print. She's written a new foreword to it. And a cookbook that Vincent Price and his wife Mary Price wrote in 1965, which is a best-selling cookbook, is back in print as well. A 50th reissue of that, and that has a foreword by Victoria Price and Wolfgang Puck. So Victoria will be in town this weekend in St. Louis for a couple of book signings and a couple of events. Friday night at Blueberry Hill, starting at 7 o'clock, she will be doing a book signing there in the Pac-Man room. And then Saturday morning over at the High Point, they always do the classic film series the second Saturday of every month anyway, so we figured with Victoria in town, we would have to do a Vincent Price movie, and since it's October, it just all worked out beautifully. We are showing House on Haunted Hill.
I'm Vincent Price, and you're invited to my party in the House on Haunted Hill, where so far the ghosts have murdered only 7 people. So won't you come and make it 8? You'll see human heads without bodies.
Which is one of everyone's favorite Vincent Price movies, directed by William Castle. I love House on Haunted Hill. Mm-hmm. It, of course, William Castle was known for his gimmicks. He did Percepto with the Tingler, where the movie theaters had a little electric shock. He had the Coward's Corner for Homicidal, where you could get your money back, but if you were too scared, you had to walk to this little booth in the corner with these glow-in-the-dark footprints leading to it.
Well, yeah, the Ghost Viewer for 13 Ghosts,
yeah.
Where you could look through one part of the glasses and not see the ghost.
Yeah.
So is she going to be here all weekend?
She'll be here Friday and Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, she's delightful. She's a wonderful woman.
But I would say his most famous gimmick was for House on Haunted Hill, where he had Emergo, the flying skeleton, that would fly over the heads of the audiences at a certain point in the film. You know, one thing about William Castle, though, I think people talk about William Castle, and they talk about his gimmicks, and I think people tend to forget that William Castle was actually an excellent director. And I think House on Haunted Hill really proves that. It's a really tight, scary 75-minute horror film from 1959.
Oh, yeah. Well, his films are just fun, you know, to watch, even without all the gimmicks. You know, they're a blast. You know, Macabre and all those flicks.
Oh, yeah. Imargo will be making an appearance at House on Haunted Hill this weekend, but he's not up to flying over the heads of the audience this time. But he will be there to sign autographs and pose for some photo ops.
Hey, get a selfie with Imargo,
get a selfie with Imargo. And, of course, Victoria Price will be there. She and I will both be introducing the film House on Haunted Hill. That's at 10:30 a.m. at the High Point. And then when the movie's over, she will be in the lobby signing her books. One other event I wanted to talk about with Victoria Price this weekend is the Tenacious Eats Movies for Foodies program, which is a film series that I host. It is this Saturday night at the Banquet Center over on Leona over in South St. Louis, kind of near the Bevo Mill. This is a film series where a movie is shown and a five-course gourmet meal is served by the terrific cooks that work for Tenacious Eats, headed by Chef Liz Schuster. And we are showing Theater of Blood from 1973, which is Vincent Price's favorite of his horror films. He plays Edward Lionheart, an actor who is snubbed by a group of critics. So he fakes his own suicide and then comes back and kills them one by one using deaths from famous Shakespeare plays. It's a great movie.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. Great cameo performances by, I think some of the British actors were almost begging to be in it. It looks like they're having so much fun.
Robert Morley.
Oh, and Jack Hawkins.
Ian Bannon.
And Vincent's assistant in it is his daughter, played by Diana Rigg.
That's right, and she's terrific.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, Coral Brown is one of the victims. Vincent Price met Coral Brown on the set of that film and had an affair and ended up leaving his wife to marry Coral Brown. We'll talk to Victoria about that. We tend to pause the movie and talk while the courses are being served, so I'm sure Victoria will have a lot of interesting things to say. Tickets are still available, by the way. Go to tenaciouseats.com and try to get some tickets for a Theater of Blood. They're $75, but it's well worth it. You get a gourmet meal, you get five paired cocktails, you get a movie, you get to meet Victoria Price, so that's a lot of fun. Michael Hafner, one of the contributing writers for OurMovieGeeks.com, attended Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas last week. We've got Michael on the phone. Michael, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, Tom. How are you?
Good, good. You didn't do any drinking down in Austin last week, did you?
I might have had one or two beers. I'm not quite sure. I don't remember, but I think I had a few.
He doesn't remember. That's a clue right there. So how was Fantastic Fest? So this is what, the fourth, fifth time you've been to this?
This is my fifth time going. I covered it for We Are Movie Geeks last year as well, and it's always a blast. It's sort of like summer camp, but for adult movie geeks that enjoy partying and watching movies, you know, practically 24 hours a day. So it's just a blast.
Did you meet anybody interesting?
Well, Elijah Wood comes every year, and so seeing him ride a mechanical bull at the closing night party, that was something. He comes every year. He's a huge fan of the fest. Noah Segan, who is an actor who was in a film called Follow, that played at the fest, he was also in the movie Looper, and he's been in a couple of other features. He was there this year again. I saw Nicholas Winding Refn, the director of Drive, and got to talk with him a little bit, and got to talk to the screenwriter of Sinister and Sinister 2, C. Robert Cargill. He's always a great guy and he's a huge movie geek like us, so he's very approachable and easy to talk to.
And you saw a lot of films. You turned in some really good reviews, Camino, The Witch, the remix ripoff, Lobster, High Rise. Those are all films that you've reviewed from Fantastic Fest in the past week at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Tell us a little about The Witch. I saw the trailer for that. That looks interesting.
The Witch is a really well-made film. It's the director's first feature, and it's a pretty ambitious film for his first feature. You would think, given by the title, and that it would just be this straight-up horror film. And it's not really that. It's more of like a psychological family drama. You know, it delves into the culture of that time period, and it's extremely historically accurate. Like, I even heard that the musical instruments that they used to create the score were all from that time period, but the just the costumes and the dialogue and everything is very, very historically accurate. I think maybe to a fault at times. It's a little hard to understand some of the dialogue because they use these specific phrases or words that were inherent to that time period, but he has a really great visual sense, and some of the imagery in it is really, really creepy. I wouldn't say it's a straight-out horror film, and anyone that's going to see the film that's expecting just a straight horror film might be a little disappointed, but it's got a really nice sense of dread to the whole thing.
Okay, Michelle has a question for you.
Hey, Michael. What was... So tell me about... What happened during the secret screening, and what did you end up seeing?
So the secret screening, there was rumors leading up to it, you know, of all sorts of things. You know, even some people heard rumors that Tarantino was seen around Austin and that they were going to screen The Hateful Eight. But when we got to the theater, Tim Lee, who's the leader of Alamo Drafthouse, he's like, you know, with some of these films, you know, that we screen for secret screenings, we sometimes show the big Hollywood films, but... this one is from this up-and-coming Latino director who, you know, you guys might not have heard of yet, but he's really going to make a big impression with this film. And we've got him here today. Let me introduce Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, he was there.
Everyone erupted in laughter. But yeah, Crimson Peak with the secret screening.
I can imagine the two of you in here as children.
We were not allowed in here as children. We were confined to the nursery in the attic.
And... they actually did a collaboration with a brewery called Firestone Walker, and they did a Crimson Peak Ale. And they gave everyone a Crimson Peak pint glass, too. That Mondo, the company that does the movie posters and T-shirts and whatnot, they did this really neat Crimson Peak pub glass. And then they had this Crimson Peak Ale, which was like a red ale that was literally the color of blood red. I mean, I don't know if they used food dye or what to create it, but... it was really good. It almost had a slight cranberry flavor to it.
It sounded like I guess they're keeping a lid on the reviews for that film, but I think you had a positive response to it pretty much, right?
Yeah, I did have a positive response. Yeah, the official reviews were, you know, asked to wait till the week of release, but people were able to tweet about it. Some people wrote out very long tweets, you know, several of them that you could pretty much combine into a review if you really wanted to, but... yeah, it's definitely a film that I think fans of Guillermo del Toro will like quite a bit. He has such a strong visual sense, and there's just a delicious performance from Jessica Chastain in the film that I think horror fans will really, really like.
Mm-hmm. Are you pleased with the R rating?
Yes, and it definitely earns its R rating in these really spastic bits of violence that are thrown in. It definitely earns its R rating, I'll say that.
Cool.
And there's a little bit of sex in there, too. The women might like a few shots of Tom Hiddleston that they have in one sequence. Yeah. So I'll say that.
Okay. You saw something called Remake, Remix, Ripoff, which is about Turkish knockoffs. And did they show some Turkish features as well? Talk about that for a minute.
They did. Yeah, they showed three Turkish features. One was the Turkish Star Wars, which actually was a film that you introduced me to, Tom.
Yeah.
I wasn't familiar with it until about a year ago.
We showed it at one of my Christmas parties.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
One of the great things that they did for the fest this year is they also brought in all these really rare Turkish movie posters. From films from Parada to 48 Hours to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and they lined the whole lobby wall with these Turkish movie posters. There were actually originals, and they were framed up and looked really neat, but it sort of set the tone for the festival really nicely, is having these exploitation seedy, horror films.
So what was it like seeing the Turkish Star Wars on the big screen?
I think a lot of people didn't know what to expect. You know, for me, I always liked the idea of those films more than actually watching the films from start to finish. But that's just my cup of tea. You know that. It's not exactly for me. Yeah, it's fun.
What would you think was the best film that you saw at Fantastic Fest last week?
Some of my favorites. My favorite was High Rise. It's a Ben Wheatley film, which Ben Wheatley directed an amazing film called Sightseers, which is a dark, dark comedy that's sort of like Natural Born Killers meets like a road trip type movie. That's on Netflix right now. You can watch that. He also did a film called Kill List and a film called A Field in England. But High Rise is with Tom Hiddleston and Jeremy Irons and Luke Evans. To me, that's up there with Mad Max Fury Road. It's probably my favorite film of the year. It was definitely my favorite film of the fest. A film that comes out next year, I think it's in March or April, is a film called Green Room. And it's about a punk band with Anton Yelchin, who's one of the members. And they get trapped inside this nightclub one night by a group of neo-Nazi punks. And the neo-Nazi punks are led by Patrick Stewart, and this really dark turn for him, really dark. But it's one of the best thrillers I've seen in such a long time. And the violence is almost, there's a couple of scenes of violence in it that made me nauseous. Like, it's so intense and so extreme. I really can't recommend that film enough, especially when it comes out next year. Another film that I really, really liked that might go under the radar for some people is a film called The Devil's Candy. It's got Ethan Embry in it, and he plays this painter whose family moves into this house, who, when the film starts, you see a murder happen in the house. And so it's got a little bit of like an Amityville horror vibe, but it also delves into other territory as well. And it's from the director of The Loved Ones. The Loved Ones was this, I think it was either Australian or New Zealand horror film that came out about 4 or 5 years ago. If you haven't seen The Loved Ones, check that out. But The Devil's Candy is a film that I think may go unnoticed, but it's a really amazing film.
Sounds like you had a good time.
I did.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me. You guys will have to come down to Fantastic Fest with me sometime.
Oh, wait, that'd be fun. I wanted to ask you, though, have you seen Green Inferno yet?
I have not. Have you guys seen it? How is it?
I've seen it. I thought it was great. Don't miss it. It's still in town.
Okay.
All right, Michael.
Sure.
All right, we're going to let you go. Take care.
All right, thanks for the call, guys.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, that was Michael Hafner talking about Fantastic Fest. He just got back in town. Sounds like he had a good time and saw a lot of great horror movie stuff that'll be playing at theaters over the next year or maybe even the next 2 years. It seems like a lot of movies play at Fantastic Fest and then they don't show up here in St. Louis for a year or two later. Green Inferno is a perfect example.
Yeah, I'm hoping that High Rise gets here pretty soon. That sounds interesting.
That sounds great.
That got stellar reviews across the board. If you look up, you know, on Internet Movie Database, everybody was just raving about it.
Yeah. Oh, good, good.
All right, a couple other things here in town. Let's see, Wednesday night is Hell Comes to Frogtown. You ever seen that, Jim, with a Rowdy Roddy Piper? And
I've seen bits of
Sandal
it over
Bergman
there.
And Big Will Smith is in there, and Rory Calhoun. It's a pretty cheesy movie. That showing is part of the what do they call it, the Strange Brew film series, which won Riverfront Times Best Film Series last
year. Saw that,
week.
Yeah.
So good for those guys. They always pick some, usually pick bad movies, but sometimes they pick good movies. I guest hosted a screening of Hard Times.
Yeah, they mentioned that on the RFT, yeah.
Yeah. So that's Wednesday night at 8 o'clock at Schlafly Bottle Works. The Classic Black Actress Festival is this weekend at the Missouri History Museum. This is something our friend James Thomas puts on. So they're showing 8 movies, each starring a famous black actress. Have you seen this list, Jim?
No, I saw the list of the actresses, but not the films.
Okay. Some of these I've never heard of. Imitation of Life, I've heard of that.
Sure.
As far as Juanita Moore, but I'm not really familiar with Juanita Moore. Anna Lucasta, have you ever heard of that?
I've not heard of her.
Eartha Kitt and Sammy Davis Jr.
Ah, Anna Lucasta, okay.
Claudine stars Diane Carroll.
And James Earl Jones, I believe, right, yes. Yeah.
Cabin in the Sky.
Oh, sure. Oh, Lena Horne. And Rochester.
Yeah. Carmen Jones. I've never seen that.
With Dorothy Dandridge.
Dandridge.
Oh, yes.
That's fantastic.
And Harry Belafonte, I believe, yes.
I was pleased to see that one.
Sounders are Cicely Tyson.
Oh, yes, yes, and Paul Winfield.
They were both nominated for Oscars for that film.
Yeah. I think Diane Carroll has a small role in Carmen Jones also, yes.
Okay. The Jackie Robinson story stars Ruby Dee, and Jackie Robinson is himself.
Yes.
And my favorite on this list is Foxy Brown starring Pam Grier.
Pam Grier, that one-chick hit squad who creamed you as coffee, is back to do a job on the mob as Foxy Brown.
You tell me who you want done, and I'll do the hell out of it.
A chick with drive who don't take no jive.
That woman, she's crazy.
That'll end the fest. That was made in 1974. That was sort of her follow-up to Coffee. One of the great blaxploitation movies of the 70s, Foxy Brown. So that is the Classic Black Actress Festival. And you'll have to go to the St. Louis Black Film Festival Facebook page to find out the times on these. I know each movie is $5, or you can go to WeirdMovieGeeks.com, where I put up an article the other day listing the times for all of these films. But definitely get out and support the St. Louis Black Film Festival in their salute to classic black actresses. Speaking of film festivals, the St. Louis International Film Festival runs November 5th through the 15th.
Yes.
And they just announced their lineup, which is pretty exciting. It's always exciting.
Yeah, it kicks off the 5th. Their opening night selection is Deep Web from director Alex Winter. Mm-hmm. He'll be honored with the Charles Guggenheim Cinema St. Louis Award. They also announced highlights of the fest will include high-profile films as The 33 about the Chilean mine collapse, that's from Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Assassin, Brooklyn, that's Fox Searchlight. Carol, the highly anticipated Carol.
Oh, yeah. Todd Haynes film, yeah.
Yeah, that was at Cannes Film Festival. The Lady in the Van, Legend, Love the Coopers, Remember, Son of Saul, which is a foreign...
The Holocaust.
Touch with Fire and Youth. Uh-huh. So that starts, that's November 5th through the 15th.
I think didn't they have Tom Hiddleston we were talking about? Isn't his Hank Williams film was going to be part of this, right?
I saw the light.
Yes. Yeah. Legend I'm really looking forward to with Tom Hardy as the Cray brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like they got a lot of the Oscar buzz movies premiering, which they do every year.
Because they are considered by the Academy of Motion Pictures qualifying the documentary shorts, I believe. So if your film is shown here and it wins, you can be potentially nominated for an Oscar.
And Love the Coopers is a Christmas comedy with Marisa Tomei, Olivia Wilde, Amanda Seyfried, Diane Keaton, mm-hmm. Alan Arkin. That looks kind of goofy, but I think it's got a great cast.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Lady in the Van is Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
Some of us have already seen that and still are touting Maggie Smith for Best Picture Best Actress.
Yeah, I think there's some Oscar buzz around Youth with Michael Caine and Harvey Keitel as well.
Oh, yes.
Lots to look forward to. I will be hosting an event at the St. Louis International Film Festival on Friday, November 13th at Webster University. It is a tribute to Todd Browning. Todd Browning was the great director who directed Freaks in 1932. We'll be showing that, but we'll also be showing a silent film he made in 1927 called The Unknown with Lon Chaney and Joan Crawford, and that will be accompanied by the Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra. So, go to cinemastlouis.org. The entire list is there right now. I think in a couple of weeks they'll have more details, times, and plot synopses. Right now it's just a list of movies that half of them haven't heard of. A lot of documentaries, a lot of shorts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The St. Louis International Film Festival is always a good time. It's always well attended, and we cover the heck out of it at WeAreMovieGeeks.com.
I should mention I was there's a little film that opened Friday in just a couple of theaters called Hell and Back, which is a animated stop motion animated film.
Oh, right.
How was that? Well, I'm going to go try to see that today.
Okay.
It's from the makers of Robot Chicken. It's only playing, I think, at Ronnie's and the AMC West Olive.
And
I'm going to check it out. It's R rated. It's got voices by Mila Kunis and Susan Sarandon and people like that. So it might be kind of interesting.
Yeah,
I'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, although it probably won't be showing. But you never know.
Maybe they'll
hold it over.
It'll be a video on demand at least or something.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to have to wrap it up. Next week, we'll be back with reviews of Pan and 99 Homes and
Malala.
Mm-hmm. Call Me Malala.
Name me Malala.
A few others. I'm going to have to end it for now. Listen to us again next week. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And we are Movie Geeks.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, naughty state. Hello, Don.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling. Black leather, rock. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling. Black leather, rock.